Simon & Schuster Audio presents Magic Lessons, the prequel to Practical Magic by Alice Hoffman. Read by Sutton Foster.
Love all, trust a few, do wrong to none. William Shakespeare. Part 1. Transformations. 1664. 1. She was found on a January day in a field where the junipers grew, wound in a blue blanket, with her name carefully stitched along the border with silk thread. There was a foot of snow on the ground, but the sun was strong, and whoever had named the child Maria had most assuredly loved her, for the wool of the blanket was of a very fine grade, certain to keep her warm, and she'd been well cared for, not lacking for comfort or food. She was a quiet baby, but as the day passed, she began to fuss, and then to cry, doing so unfailingly and with great effort, until at last a crow came to perch on her basket, peering at her with its quick black eyes. That was how the old woman discovered the abandoned child, staring at a bird nearly as large as herself, fearless and wide-eyed from the start. Maria was a beautiful baby, with pitch-black hair and pale gray eyes, a silvery shade so unusual the old woman wondered if she wasn't a changeling. For this was a place where strange things happened, and fate could be a friend or a foe. Changeling or not, Hannah Owens carried the baby back into the woods, singing as they went, the first human words the baby would remember.
The water is wide, I cannot get o'er it, and neither have I wings to fly. Give me a boat that will carry two, and I shall row my love and I. Oh, down in the meadows the other day, a gathering flowers both fine and gay, a gathering flowers both red and blue, I little thought of what love could do.
In the child's first days at Hannah's cottage, the insistent bird beat his wings against the cloudy, pitted glass window, doing his best to be let in. He could not be chased off with pails of vinegar and water, nor with shouts and threats. One could hardly toss stones at such a loyal creature. The crow had been allowed to stay, and was called Caden, a name derived from Maria's baby talk name of Caw-Caw. Whenever the weather turned foul, he settled onto the wooden perch kept beside the sooty fire. There he cleaned his gleaming feathers and kept a sharp eye on Maria. "I suppose he's yours," Hannah said to the baby in her basket, when 7 days had passed and the crow had not left his post on the fence surrounding the garden, not even to eat or drink. "Or perhaps you're his." Hannah knew full well that you do not choose a familiar. It chooses you, bonding with you in a way no other creature can. Hannah herself had long ago made a pet of a she-cat that had followed her everywhere, a pretty marmalade-colored tabby with lovely markings, a beloved familiar that was in tune with her thoughts and desires. On the day Hannah was let out of prison, she found the cat nailed to the door of her house in the village. That's what her neighbors had done while she'd been imprisoned, as well as robbing her of the few belongings she'd had, a feather mattress, some pots and pans, a quill pen. Hannah carried the cat with her into the woods and buried it in the green hollow where she had camped before her cottage was built, a glade she called Devotion Field, where bluebells grew in the spring and celandine shone through the last of the winter frost in a carpet of white and yellow stars. The beauty of that meadow reminded Hannah of the reasons to live in the world, and the reasons to mistrust those who saw wickedness in others, but never in themselves. The natural world was at the heart of her craft. What grew in the woods could harm or heal. And it was her obligation to know the difference. It was part of Old Norse tradition, cider, that had been brought to England in the ancient times. This was green magic, visionary in nature, blending the soul of the individual with the soul of the earth. Tree magic. Holly should be burned to announce the end of winter. Rowan, sacred to witches for protection for making spindles and spinning wheels. Hazel will lead to water. Willow is sacred magic, transporting the soul. Yew signifies life, death, and rebirth, used for bows. Beware, the seeds are poisonous. Ash is sacred and healing. The leaves make a tonic for horses. Apple is the key to magic and is used for medicine, love spells. Birch, write spells on strips of bark and they will reach their intended. Pine tree sap is a salve for pox and spotted fever. The leaves of the larch tree boiled as an ointment for wounds and cuts. Hemlock will cure swellings and sores. It was indeed good fortune that the child had been found by Hannah, and not by another, for there were many in Essex County who would have disposed of an unwanted baby as easily as they'd have drowned a cat. Hannah was a kind and generous soul, and she didn't think twice before giving the baby a home, and, as it turned out, a great deal more. She stitched a blue dress for the child, for good fortune and protection, and tied a strand of blue wool around her ankle. Residents of nearby villages and towns believed that among the good and decent folk, there were hidden servants of evil who caused children to die of pox and fevers, and could curse the land so that it lay fallow. What people believed often came to be, and blame was placed where it was imagined. This was the year when two comets streaked across the sky for mysterious causes, and a volcano that had begun to erupt at Mount Etna in Italy would soon spread ash as far as their own village, so that it seemed to snow in March. Within a year, two poor souls in London were infected with the plague, with more and more falling ill each day. People wore masks and locked themselves in their houses, yet the illness still found them, sliding under doors, it was believed, or flowing through windows. But in truth, the disease had been brought from house to house by doctors who didn't know well enough to wash their hands. By 1665, the city would lose 68,000 inhabitants. When Maria turned 2, the Great Fire of London destroyed 70,000 homes in a city of 80,000, and smoke filled the air for the entire month of September. Birds fell from the sky, and children coughed up black phlegm, a sign they would not see their next birthday. The world was a dangerous place, where people were punished for their sins and most believed that good fortune depended upon a measure of faith and superstition. These were years when cruel and unexplained things happened, and kindness was a rare and valued gift, one that Hannah Owens happened to possess. There were those in the county known to practice the nameless art, spells and rituals handed down through the generations by cunning folk who knew more than most. These women understood the mysterious nature of medicine and love, and did their best to pierce the veil that separated men and women from knowledge that might save them from ill fortune and disaster. They could mend a broken heart as easily as they could cure a fever, but they did so discreetly, for women were blamed for much of the world's troubles, and there were known to be witches in this county. More than 20 years earlier, Matthew Hopkins, a young man from the village of Manningtree, on the banks of the River Stour in Essex County, had begun his wicked hunt for witches. Aided by the Earls of Warwick and Manchester, he became the Witch Finder General and was paid a lordly amount for sending women to their deaths. What made for a witch was in his hands, as if he alone could see through the spectral curtain and pluck out the evidence of evil. A mark on a woman's hand or cheek, a bird at her window, a dog or cat or some other creature that would not leave her side. A book of magic found in a cupboard, or discovered beneath a straw mattress. An embittered neighbor with a grudge and a story to tell. Such was the manner of proof, especially when it came to poor women without a family or a champion. In the time of the witch finder, it was believed a witch could be ensnared by nailing her steps to the ground so that she could not flee, and iron traps made to catch fox were set out, for it was well known that a witch's powers decreased when she was near metal. Some witch hunters actually nailed women's feet to the ground and left them to try to escape. If they were able to evade their captors, they then needed to dab rosemary oil on the spot where the nail had entered them while invoking a spell of protection and vengeance. This cannot harm you on this day. When you walk away. When you return, all your enemies will burn. Still, protection was hard to find. 300 suspects were charged. 100 of these poor souls went to the gallows, having been tested by being tied to a chair and tossed into a river or pond to see if they would drown or if they would float like a witch. It was a test that was impossible to win. Hannah Owens had been fortunate to have escaped a hanging. For the trials were stopped and the madness was broken, much like a fever, suddenly and for no apparent reason, other than the fact that logic finally prevailed. The accused were let out of prison, grateful even though there were no apologies or explanations, and certainly no reparations. Hopkins died in his 20s of the coughing disease, said to have been contracted after he had been swimming. There were many who were overjoyed to hear that he'd been damned with his own version of drowning, his lungs filling with water that had sunk him as surely as if he'd been tied to a stool and forcibly immersed in a pond. On the day he was buried, scores of women in Essex County celebrated, with bonfires burning and mugs of ale poured and enjoyed. As for Hannah, she'd had a cup of tea on that day, made of a mixture she had blended to give herself courage during these dreadful times, when a woman couldn't walk down the street without fear of being accused of misdoings, especially if a book was found in her belongings, or if she could read and write her own name. Although the mania had died down, mothers continued to tie their babies to their cradles to make certain they wouldn't be stolen in the night, setting bowls of precious salt on their windowsills to protect those inside. Men nailed upside-down horseshoes above barn doors to ensure that their luck wouldn't run out, for they privately feared that a witch could ruin any strong man's health by placing a strand of his hair or his fingernail clippings under the eaves of a house. Children were taught never to speak to strangers. Should they stray and be bewitched, they must shout out numbers backwards as a way to break the enchantment. Those unfortunate children who did go missing were searched for with pitchers of goat's milk, said to be a witch's favorite drink, and many times, children who had been spirited away appeared at the door late at night, with burrs in their hair and no practical excuse to give their mothers, other than a thin apology and a claim they'd become lost in the woods and could not for the life of them find their way home. Hannah Owens lived apart from the delusions and bad intentions of men, as deep in the forest as possible, in a small cottage hidden by vines. She'd had it built by a local carpenter, a fellow no one would hire due to a deformity at birth, a simple, honest man who later claimed the old woman had blessed him and given him a salve she had concocted from her apothecary garden that had made his withered arm bloom and become whole again. The roof of Hannah's house was thatched, and the chimney was plaited with reeds and clay, with a pot of water kept near the hearth in case a spark should catch the reeds on fire. The path to her door was made of uneven blue stones, hidden by shrubs. So much the better, for the difficult going provided protection from prying eyes. And still women from town and from neighboring farms managed to find their way when the need arose, setting the brass bell to ringing when they knocked on the door. Hannah knew the woods as well as anyone. She knew that counting the knots on a lilac bush could predict the number of cold spells, and that if you lit a bit of snow with some tinder and it melted quickly, the snow on the ground would soon disappear. Nutmeg opened the heart, lily was useful for rashes, and arnica could make a man burn with desire. When a baby refused to be born or would not nurse, when a child was ailing and feverish, when a husband strayed, when a candle burst into flame of its own accord, marking a spirit lurking nearby, women came to Hannah Owen's door, and for the price of some eggs or a pitcher of goat's milk, or in the most difficult cases, a brooch or a ring, a remedy could be found. Maria grew up watching such transactions, always after nightfall, for no one wished to be seen at the witch's door. Hanging on the wall was the lucky hand, an amulet shaped into five fingers, made from moss, preserved on Midsummer's Eve with the smoke of a bonfire, which would protect the house from bad luck and ill fortune. The women who came calling sat at the kitchen table where bread was kneaded and hens were butchered and babies were born, often after a difficult labor. By the age of five, Maria had been taught how to turn a baby in its mother's womb, how to grind a bird's bones into a powder to combat sleeplessness, how to identify the symptoms of a fever or a pox. She had been given close instructions on which herbs were best to gather, carrying them home in a basket or in the skirt of her long apron. Wood avens to cure toothache, black horehound for nausea and monthly cramps, salted leaves that could be used to dress and heal the bite of a dog, elderberry and cherry bark for coughs, dill seeds to be rid of hiccups, hawthorn to disperse bad dreams and calm a frantic heart, and nettle, which made a fine soup, to treat burns, infections, and inflammations. Maria only had to touch the clump of nettle once without gloves to learn her lesson. Even after Hannah had rubbed the crumpled leaves of the jewelweed plant to calm the afflicted skin, Maria avoided these stinging plants forever after. From the start, the girl was a quick learner. She didn't have to be hurt twice to be wary. And she knew early on that love could be either a blessing or a curse. The women who made their way through the woods most often came for one thing. Time and time again, it was love. Love everlasting, young love, love defiled, love that caused aches and pains, love that left bruises and red welts, love wished for desperately, or love to be rid of as quickly as possible. Often Hannah wrote down the desired result and placed the bit of parchment in her spell box. She cast her spells while lighting a candle. White for health, black for expunging sorrow, red for love. Prick the third finger of the left hand with a silver needle to bring back a lover. The power of a spell increased with the waxing moon and decreased with the waning moon. Time mattered, devotion mattered, belief mattered most of all. Maria sat by the hearth, which was hers to tend, for she had her own tinder box and could start a fire in a flash. From that warm and cozy spot, she watched Hannah scan the pages of her book, filled with remedies and spells, careful to take note of the potions and powders that were prescribed. Amulets of apple seeds and menstrual blood, doses of henbane that could bind a couple together, or if used to excess, could cause delirium or death. The heart of a deer or a dove that brought about devotion even in the most feckless and untrustworthy of men, and fragrant verbena, which, depending on its use and what the user desired, could bring a man to you or cause him to be impotent. "Remember one thing," Hannah told Maria. "Always love someone who will love you back." Practical materials. Candles. Essential oil. Lavender for calming. Sage to purify. Rosemary for remembrance. Rose for love. Salt, garlic, stones, thread, talismans for fortune, love, luck, and good health. Always meet and depart from inside a circle. Honor the 12 full moons in a year from December until November. Oak, wolf, storm, hare, seed, dryad, mead, herb, barley, harvest, hunters, snow, and the 13th moon, always most special, the blue moon. Silver coins, pure water, willow, birch, rowan, oak, string, knots, mirrors, black glass, brass bowls, pure water, blood, ink, pens, paper. Nettle will give protection and return evil to sender. Apple for rebirth and immortality. Holly leads to dream magic, but can be poisonous. Blackthorn can return evil to the sender. Ferns call rain, but fend off lightning. Feverfew to ward off illness. Wormwood is poisonous, but can be used for divination. Belladonna, though poisonous, can cause visions and give the power of the sight. Mint on your windowsill will keep away flies and bad fortune. Lavender for luck. Hannah Owens was unusual not only for her kindness and herbal knowledge, but for the stunning fact that she could both write and read, a rare skill, for a working woman in the country was expected to have no more formal learning than a plow horse, and 90% were illiterate. Hannah had been an orphan herself, but she had been raised in the scullery of a royal house to do kitchen work, and there the tutor for the family's sons had taken it upon himself to allow her into the library and teach her to read. As soon as Maria was old enough, Hannah taught her precious talents to the child on stormy nights when the weather was too awful for even the most lovesick women to come to the door. They sat in the light of a lantern and drank cups of courage tea, a blend of currants, spices, and thyme, made for protection and healing, a mixture that needed to steep for a long time. It was an elixir that made it clear one should never hide who one was. That was the first step toward courage. In this way, magic began. The crooked black letters looked like nothing more than circles and sticks. And then, all at once, after weeks of attention, they became words that took on the shape of cows and clouds and rivers and seas. A miracle on the page, drawn with ink made of oak seeds or plant sap or animal blood or the damp ash of charred bones. There were sympathetic inks that few knew of. A scribe could write with one, and it would not be seen until a second ink was used, or when lime juice, milk, or vinegar were brushed onto the paper, and then, after heat was applied, the message would suddenly be visible. This was true magic, the making and unmaking of the world with paper and ink. It was said that if any of God's creatures could think like a man, it would be a crow, for they have minds that never rest. Caden was a great collector and brought back all manners of treasures discovered in the surrounding villages and towns, found at the great estates as well as the laborers' hovels, spied from above by his bright vision of the world below. What belonged to others was fair game for him to steal, and rich or poor made no difference. They all had something worthwhile. He could flick in through a window and flit out again, or dive into a trash bin or pick through a garden. Buttons, spools of thread, coins, children's poppets, horsehairs, and once, on a bright blue day when he could see farther than any other beast or man, he brought back a hairpin, clearly stolen from a lady in a castle, a lovely, intricate object, that had tiny rubies set into the silver. Maria, now nearly 8, was in the meadow when Caden swooped down to drop this miraculous find at her feet. He had been somewhat wounded in his attempts at stealing the treasure he now offered, and there was a small scar on his head. Maria wore a blue skirt and a woolen bodice with narrow sleeves, along with stockings Hannah knitted and a linen smock. The child was still as fearless as ever. What fell from the sky, she was happy to collect and examine. "Oh, look, Hannah," she cried. "My Caden's a robber." Hannah came around from the apothecary garden as Maria was studying the pin that had been cast into the tall grass. In the girl's hands, the silver turned black in an instant, as if brushed with dark paint, though the rubies shone more brightly because of her touch. Hannah clutched the leeks she had gathered to her chest and felt an ache inside her bones. The wide-brimmed straw hat she wore to protect her from the sun fell from her head, and she didn't bother to go after it. What she had long suspected had now been shown to be true. She'd felt it from the start, that first day under the junipers, when she spied the baby in her basket, a rare sight that had spread cold pinpricks along her spine. As she'd unwrapped Maria from her blanket, she'd spied an unusual birthmark in the shape of a star hidden in the crease of the girl's inner elbow. Right away, she wondered if this was the cause of the child's abandonment, for bloodline witches were said to be marked in such sly, concealed places, on the scalp, upon the small of the back, at the breastbone, along the inner arm. It was one thing to learn magic, but quite another to be born with it. Ever since, Hannah had kept watch for telltale signs. Over the years, omens had appeared, one after the other, clear evidence of the child's unusual nature. As soon as she could speak, Maria could predict the weather, just as a crow can tell when a windstorm will come, often beginning to fly erratically hours before the first gusts. Maria could taste snow in the air and know the skies would open before rain fell. She had the ability to speak backwards, an unsettling trait, and it sometimes seemed she could converse in the language of birds, calling the crow to her with a sharp clacking sound and chattering with magpies and doves. Even the cheeky sparrows came to her when she called and sat in the palm of her hand, calmed by her presence and comforted by her touch. When only a babe, she cut her finger on a thorn bush, and the blood that spilled onto the ground had burned through the grass, turning it black. That was when Hannah first felt her suspicions to be correct, but if she wanted undisputable proof, it was now right in front of her. For silver turns black when held in a witch's hand.
"I ruined it," Maria said, frowning as she showed off the blackened hairpin.
"Nonsense. You've made it far prettier. See how the red stones glow?" Hannah had the girl turn around so that her long hair could be gathered and tacked up with the crow's pin to keep the tangled mass atop her head. "Now you look like a queen." Later, Hannah caught the girl staring in a handheld mirror. It was black painted glass in which a person could see her future if she knew what to look for. Some called it scrying, or prophesizing, but it could only be properly handled by a true witch. Hannah chuckled when she saw how entranced Maria was by her own countenance, for clearly the girl had the gift of sight. Still, Hannah feared for her fate, for this was the day when Maria realized she would be beautiful, for all the good it would do her in this cruel, heartless world. Whatever her heritage might be, there was magic in Maria. At 8, her letters were more shapely than Hannah's. At 9, she could read as well as any educated man. Had she been allowed to access books in Latin and Hebrew and Greek, surely she would have learned those ancient languages as well. Hopefully, her canny intelligence would benefit her when she was on her own, a future Hannah fretted over, and the cause of many sleepless nights.
A child unprotected was at the mercy of those who wished to ill-use her. As the ultimate protection against the merciless ways of fate, Hannah began work on the only legacy she could give the child, a personal journal called a grimoire, meant for the eyes of the user alone, a book of illumination in which cures and remedies and enchantments were documented. Some called such a text a book of shadows, for it was meant solely for the use of the writer, and the formulas within often disappeared when looked at by a stranger. The first grimoire was said to be the Key of Solomon, perhaps written by King Solomon, or, far less impressive, by a magician in Italy or Greece in the 15th century. The book contained instructions for the making of amulets, as well as invocations and curses, listing the rules for summoning love and revenge. Solomon was believed to have been given a ring engraved with a pentagram that had the power to bind demons, and there were those who said that the angel Raziel gave Noah a secret book about the art of astrology, written on a single sapphire, and brought with him on the ark. The Sworn Book of Honorius, an ancient magical treatise Hannah had found in the royal family's library when she was a girl, advised no woman should be allowed to read its incantations and invocations. Those women who could read were revered and feared, for they were the most skilled in love magic. Magical practitioners were everywhere in England, in the court and in castles, but magic books were forbidden for the poor and for women. There were searches for magical manuscripts belonging to women, which were often found hidden under beds, or to avoid discovery once doubt had been cast upon the writer, floating in rivers or thrown onto burning pyres so that their magic would not fall into the wrong hands. Spells and magical symbols were written upon parchment, then tucked into the folds of clothing or into the food of the intended objects of desire. But it was a woman's personal book that was most important. Here she would record the correct recipes for all manner of enchantments. How to conjure, how to heal, including those illnesses that had no name, how to use natural magic to bind another to you or send him away, and how to use literary magic, the writing of charms and amulets and incantations, for there was no magic as coveted or as effective as that which used words. Whereas Hannah's grimoire had vellum pages and a wooden cover, the book she fashioned for Maria was a true prize, a magical object in and of itself. It was made of real paper, dearly bought from a printer in the village. The cover was black and bumpy and cool to the touch, unmistakably supernatural in nature, made of a most unusual material. Caden had led her to the shallows of a nearby pond, where she found a large toad floating on the calm surface, already cold and lifeless when Hannah knelt to hold it in her hands. For those who were uneducated, toads were full of evil magic, and witches were said to transform themselves into toads if need be. This toad's fate would be to guard a treasure trove of cures and remedies. As Hannah walked home in the fading dark, the toad's skin sparked with light. This made it clear that a grimoire formed from this creature would have its own power and would give strength to the written enchantments it bore. Any spell would be twice as potent. Hannah prepared the leather that very night, secretly and with great skill, salting the skin before stretching it on a wooden rack. Overnight, the toad leather grew twice as large as it had been, taking on the form of a square, which signified the mystical shape of the heart, combining the human and the divine and representing the four elements: fire, earth, air, and water. It was an omen of power and heartbreak and love. When presented with the book, on Midsummer night in the year she turned 10, Maria cried hot tears, the first time she could recall doing so. For although witches are said to be unable to cry, rare occasions cause them to do so. Maria was swept up by raw emotion and gratitude, and from that day forward she cried when she was flooded by her responses, burning her own skin with her dark, salty tears. Never in her life had anything truly belonged to her and her alone. She marked this day forever after as the day of her birth, for it was, indeed, the formation of the woman she would become. Her fate was tied to this book as if her future had been written with indelible ink. On the first page were the rules of magic, ones Hannah declared they were obliged to follow. Do as you will, but harm no one. What you give will be returned to you threefold. From then on, each day was a lesson, with more and more to study. For it seemed there might not be time for all that Maria must learn. Hannah had begun to hear the clatter of the Death Watch beetle inside the house, the dreaded creature whose sound echoed in times of plague and famine and illness, predicting the end of a life. One could never be sure whose life was in peril, but on this occasion Hannah knew. After finding a small, neat hole in the wall beside her bed, set there from the creature's burrowing, Hannah held up a burning twig to smoke out the beetle with yellow sulfurous fumes, but it did no good. If anything, the clicking grew louder, deafening at times, for there was no way to prevent a death that had already been cast, as every man and woman who walks the earth is bound to know when their own time comes. Perhaps the girl had foreseen Hannah's death before Hannah herself had. For Maria worked harder than ever, studying by lamplight, doing her best to ascertain if a curse could be reversed and a death unmade. At 10, she was old enough to be aware of the unkind ways of the world. She'd heard the stories Hannah's clients told, and had seen those who were too ill to be saved by any means. She knew that life and death walked hand in hand, and understood when Hannah confided that a grimoire must be handed down to a blood relative or destroyed upon the owner's death. Magic was dangerous if set in the wrong hands. At the hour of her adoptive mother's death, Maria must burn her book even before she accompanied Hannah's body to the burying ground. She had begun her own book, with Hannah's lessons taking up the early pages, and these would always remain a treasure. Maria wrote carefully, with curving, near-perfect script, using ink made of the bark of hawthorn and oak trees and the ashy bones of doves she had found strewn in the grass. Maria made a bond with doves, as she had all birds, and much later in her life she would be grateful she had done so. For love. Boil yarrow into a tea. Prick the third finger of your hand. Add 3 drops of blood and give to your beloved. Never cut parsley with a knife if you are in love, or bad luck will come your way. Salt tossed on the fire for 7 days will bring an errant lover home. Charms for wandering husbands. Feather, hair, blood, bone. Prick a candle with a pin. When the flame burns down to the pin, your true love will arrive. To win the favor of Venus in all matters of love, gather a white garment, a dove, a circle, a star, the 7th day, the 7th month, the 7 stars. To study love with an expert is a great gift, and yet Maria wondered why, with access to so much power and magic, Hannah had spent her own life alone, without love. "What makes you think I have?" Hannah didn't look the girl in the eye when she spoke, perhaps for fear of what the sight would allow Maria to intuit, things that were best kept private. There are secrets that must be held close, and most of these have to do with the wounding of the human heart, for sorrow spoken aloud is sorrow lived through twice. All the same, Maria didn't let her questions go unanswered, and now she was even more curious. "Haven't you? I've seen no man come near." Did you think I had no life before you came along? This notion only caused Maria's interest to pique. She pondered that statement, her mouth pursed, deep in thought. Contemplating her own personal history, she had begun to wonder who she'd been before she was left in Devotion Field on a snowy day. Who had given her life and loved her, only to have left her in the care of a crow? Did she resemble her mother or her father? For surely every individual who was born must have parents. She noticed then that Hannah's eyes were damp, and not because of the sun's glare. That was when she knew the truth about Hannah. "You did know love," Maria declared, quite convinced. She didn't just presume such a thing, as much as she read it in the air. As if Hannah's past was made up of letters set into a book, and that book was the world they walked through. They were deep in the forest where Hannah was schooling Maria on how to hide, should the need arise. Ever since the days of the witchfinders, it had been necessary to plan an escape at all times. Birds lived in such a manner, settling into the thickets so deeply and with such complete silence not even a fox could spy them. Hannah gave the girl a sharp look. "You're not invisible if you talk." Maria crouched beneath the junipers, barely breathing, not far from the place where she'd first been found. She knew the value of silence. Caden was perched on the branch above her, equally quiet. Perhaps he had the sight as well, as familiars are said to do. He had not spent a single night away from Maria from the time he'd found her in the field, and Maria always wore the blackened silver hairpin the crow had brought her as a special gift. Sometimes she imagined the pin in a woman's long red hair. Perhaps it was a vision of the original owner. Whatever its history, the hairpin was her most valued possession, and would be all her life, even when she was half a world away from these woods. "Bring me something wonderful," she always whispered to Caden when he set off on a flight, and she patted the feathers of her beloved thief. "Just don't be caught." On the day of invisibility, he went off when they were finished hiding, winging across the field. It was very warm, and the leaves of the willows were unfolding in a haze of soft yellow-green color. The ground was marshy all around them, and ferns covered the heathland. On the way back to the cottage, Hannah said, "You're right." She looked straight ahead as she spoke, but she had an open expression on her face, as if she were young again. She was remembering something she had done her best to forget. Maria hurried to keep up with her. "Am I?" Being told she was right was a rare treat, for Hannah believed that character was built when it was assumed that a child was most often wrong and still had much to learn. He was a man like any other, an earl's servant who had 7 years to work off his debt. That is what poor men must do, and I didn't fault him for it. I was willing to wait, for a year is only as long as you let it be, but then I was arrested. They said I used my skill at writing to send letters to the devil, and that I had a tail, and that all men were in danger when I walked by, not because I was beautiful, I wasn't, even I knew that, but because I could cause their blood to boil or go ice cold. I suppose they made it worth his while to turn against me. For after my trial was over, he was a free man with coins in his purse. He was the one who said I had a tail, and that he'd chopped it off himself so I might appear to be a woman rather than a witch. He gave them the tail of a shrew and vowed it was mine. And if a fool is believed, then those who believe him are even bigger fools. Maria thought over this new information.
"So that is love?"
Hannah glanced away, as she did when she didn't wish to reveal her emotions. But she needn't have bothered attempting to hide her sorrow, for Maria could sense what a person was feeling so strongly, she might as well have been able to hear someone's deepest fears and wishes spoken aloud. "It can't be," Maria decided. "It was for me," Hannah told her.
And for me?
You looked in the black mirror. What did you see?
It was a private matter. But this was a time for truth rather than privacy.
I saw a daughter.
Did you now? Then you'll be a fortunate woman.
And a man who brought me diamonds.
Hannah laughed out loud. There they were in their ragged clothes, half a day's walk from the nearest village with nothing precious between them save for their wits and Maria's stolen hairpin, as far away from a man with diamonds as they could be. I wouldn't be surprised by anything that happened to you, my girl, Hannah told Maria. But I believe you will be amazed at the turns of fate, as we all are when it comes to our own lives, even when we have the sight.
A church bell rang miles away. Maria had never been to the closest village. She had never seen the blacksmith's shop where irons were cast, and knew nothing of constables or church wardens or toll takers or surgeons who believed in using leeches and live worms and foxes' lungs as cures, and medical men who disdained folk remedies. Hannah placed her faith in washing her hands with clean water and her strong black soap before any examination, and because of this, she lost far fewer patients. None, as a matter of fact, except those who were too far gone for any remedy, for things without remedy must be without regard. She made her own black soap every March, enough to last the year long, burning wood from rowans and hazel woods for the ashes that would form her lye, using licorice-infused oil, honey, and clove, adding dried lavender for luck, and rosemary for remembrance. Ladles of liquid soap were poured into wooden molds, where they hardened into bars. Maria had written down the recipe in her grimoire, for this soap was most often asked for by the women from town. They said a woman grew younger each time she used it. If she had sorrows, the soap washed them away. And if there was an illness in the house, it would not spread, for the herbs in the soap defeated fevers and chills. It was the sort of recipe one could add to however one saw fit. Mistletoe for those who wished for children. Vervain to escape one's enemies. Black mustard seed to repel nightmares. Lilac for love. This year there was a coughing illness in the village, and people still feared the wave of fatalities that had passed among them only a few years earlier when the Black Death was everywhere. Small towns had disappeared entirely, with none left behind to bury the dead, and cattle soon enough had made their homes in abandoned houses, where there were no roofs or windows or doors. In their village, women turned away from the doctor, for he had never been to school, and believed in bloodletting and using stones and petrified wood to discern both the illness and the cure. Instead, they came to Hannah, in the night, along the path where the ferns were green and sweet, so that the world seemed brand new, and anything seemed possible, even salvation. For health. Wash your hands with lye soap before treating the ill person. Horehound, boiled into a syrup for coughs. Tea of wild onions and lobelia to soothe. Bee balm for a restful sleep. Vinegar elixirs stop nosebleeds. Eat raw garlic every day and a cup of hot water with lemon and honey. For asthma, drink chamomile tea. For chills, ginger root tea. Licorice root gathered from the riverside for chest pain. Dragon's blood from tree bark. And berries of the Dracaena draco, the red resin tree from Morocco and the Canary Islands, that can only be found in one market in London and can cure nearly any wound. A live snail rubbed on burns will help heal the blisters. Feed a cold, starve a fever. In the summer of 1674, a time of unusual heat, a woman with red hair arrived at the cottage. As fate would have it, she brought the future with her. She knocked at the door, and Hannah said, "Come in," even though she seemed to hesitate. Bad news often came this way without warning, on what appeared to be nothing more than an ordinary day. The visitor had on beautiful, muddy clothes. Her shoes were made of kid leather, dyed red, decorated with buckles, and she carried a cloak made of fine blue wool, fringed with the fur of a fox. She wore a linen gown dyed scarlet with madder root and a silk-corded petticoat. Yet beneath her lovely, ruined clothes, purple bruises bloomed upon her skin, and there were marks left from a rope that had been tied around her wrists. From her place by the fire, Maria stared at the red-haired lady. The stranger was so elegant, with a pretty, calm voice. She said her name was Rebecca, and that she needed to spend the night. Hannah allowed her to sleep on a pallet of straw, knowing that though good deeds should bring good luck, such results aren't always the case. The red-haired lady announced she was in search of a remedy to quench her husband's fire for her. Hannah explained to Maria that the lady was running away from her husband, which was a perilous proposition, especially when there was another man in the picture, the one she truly loved. She needed a cure to protect her and allow her to leave her wedded life. "Is this what love does?" Maria wished to know. "That's not the name I'd give it," Hannah responded. "Is it so different than your man, who claimed you had a tail?" "Perhaps not, but at least he was a coward and never set his hands on me." In the morning, after a quiet night of sleep, their visitor was in better spirits. Hannah crafted an amulet of apple seeds. She then added mandrake, the heart of all love potions, first mentioned as such in Genesis, referred to as Circe's plant by the Greeks. The roots of this plant grow in the shape of human limbs, combining the aspect of a dragon and a man. It was so powerful that some refused to pick it themselves, and instead attached the plant to a rope wound around a dog's neck so that the dog would be party to the mandrake's wrath when it was pulled from the earth, for the plant screamed when it was taken, its roots torn from the comfort of the soil in which it grew. Rebecca admitted she had cast a spell on her husband years earlier. She had bound him to her, bewitching him with the 10th love potion, a spell far too dangerous for common use. "Wrap a red candle on which his name and yours is written on red paper. Soak in dove's blood and burn through the night, saying the words, 'Love conquers all, so it must be. Let him burn with love for me. My lover's heart will feel this pin, and his devotion I will win. There will be no way for him to rest or sleep until he comes to me to speak. Only when he loves me best will he find peace, and with peace, rest." The incantation must be recited while stabbing a dove's heart with 7 pins on the 7th day of the week. For the use of the 10th, an enchantment too strong for the usual manner of dissolving spells, Rebecca had paid a steep price. She could not undo the magic she had called onto herself, though she had tried for more than 10 years. To change what she had wrought, Rebecca needed help from another woman, one who was adept at magic and could reverse the spell entirely. Hannah was that person, a master at the nameless art. After she made the charm, she wrote Rebecca's name and her bewitched husband's name on a white candle coated with myrrh oil. She then had Rebecca say, "I burn this candle as a token of the spell that binds our love. Let this magic now be broken by the gods above." Hannah wrapped the candle in white cloth, for pure intentions must be cloaked in pure fabric. Then she brought her visitor to the nearby pond,
where she flung the candle as far as it could go. Maria stood behind Hannah and Rebecca as they watched it sink. They could all feel the spell breaking apart, as if dust were sifting down from the sky. For one wild moment, all three danced in a ring, forgetting the many trials of this world. Rebecca then insisted she must wash the mud and bloodstains from her clothes. She did so, and then she set them to dry on the twiggy branches of the low-growing shrubbery. Rebecca wore several amulets and charms, acorns and agate strung on red thread, and a brass circle onto which a pentacle had been etched. On both her wrists, she wore spells that had been knotted and woven into bracelets for protection. It was summer, and so hot the birds remained in the shadows. "Careful," the sparrows told Maria, warning her not to go near. Caden took one look at Rebecca and flew away, making sure to keep his distance. But Maria was entranced by the stranger, who was so alluring. Hannah gave their visitor a bar of black soap, and Rebecca walked to the shore, past the reeds, into the cool green water. She was still wearing her undergarments embroidered with blue thread, but they could see enough of her to spy that behind one knee, there was a red mark in the shape of a crescent. Maria stepped closer. She herself had the mark of a star on her arm. Hannah always had Maria wash with water from a bucket, never from the pond. But now Maria longed to take off her clothes and bathe. Hannah grabbed her by the arm and said, "No, you mustn't. Water reveals who you are." Maria had never been allowed to go near the pond, but now she felt the call of the cool water. She noticed that every time Rebecca attempted to dive under the surface, it was no use. Again and again, she sprung back up and clearly was too buoyant to dive or swim beneath the currents. She gave up, washed with the black soap, then floated back to the shore. She drifted like a lily pad, with no effort. A spoiled, beautiful flower. "What's wrong with her?" Maria asked. "Her kind can't be drowned. She's a bloodline witch. Whether it's wrong or right is not for us to say. She has magic in her." Maria thought this over as she watched the woman dress, for her clothes had already dried in the sunlight. The black soap had caused her to appear even younger and more beautiful. But witch or not, she was still covered in bruises. She should have come earlier if she'd wanted a cure for her husband's love, as so many women before her had done, but perhaps she'd been prevented from running away. Runaways were dangerous. They brought trouble on their heels. Maria could smell it brewing. It smelled like blood and fire. "I'll be gone soon enough," the Lady Rebecca assured them as they walked back to the cottage. Her silk petticoat rustled, and she was lovely to look at. She'd brought death with her, as the enchanted often do, yet she was so captivating that Maria found herself charmed by her all over again. When Rebecca rested her hand on the girl's head, she noticed the hairpin. "Look!" She bent down so that Maria could see the back of her head. "I have one like it. I used to have another, but I was a fool and lost it to a black bird that was upon me before I could be rid of him." Maria bit her lip. Surely this was the work of Caden's thievery. "You can have this one," she was quick to say. "Then you'll have two again." "I'm grateful, but it gives me pleasure to see you wear it. Let us vow to wear them every day." Later, as Hannah was fixing supper, Maria came to help her. They had eggs from their hen and mushrooms from the woods. Hannah did not eat beef or lamb, and they would have a vegetable soup for their dinner, served directly from the cast iron pot. Maria was too curious to stop herself from asking, "Why did she come here? If she has her own magic, why doesn't she use it?" "Working magic for yourself is tricky. It should be something you use to help others. If you use it for yourself, it can backfire and bring you untold troubles. As you may be able to tell, our visitor is not exactly selfless. She set an unbreakable spell and now regrets what she did. Let that be a lesson to you. Hannah knew exactly who this woman was. She had seen a spool of blue thread in the satchel the lady carried, and a pile of tarnished silver coins. It's likely she's come for more than a spell. Maria furrowed her brow, confused. Just because you lose something doesn't mean you don't want to see how it's turned out, Hannah told the girl.
And has she? Maria asked.
She's seen how right you turned out, hasn't she? That was when Maria knew. The stranger was her mother. Hannah glanced at the girl's shining face. It was never a good idea to place one's faith in someone who was by her very nature undependable. Rebecca's presence meant there was trouble ahead. There was a reason she hadn't come to see her child before now. She'd had other things on her mind. Love for some people was like that, easy to slip on and off. I don't think she'll be here much longer, Hannah assured Maria. Now that she's seen what she's come to see, she'll be gone by morning. And don't expect her to say goodbye. When Maria turned to the pond to wash the supper dishes, she crouched down and dipped her fingers in the silky water. She was usually a well-behaved girl, but now she hastily stripped off her clothes, leaving her shift, her skirt, and her smock on the ground. She felt the prick of a strange sort of freedom as she stood there in the damp evening air, doing as she pleased. Maria had never before questioned her situation. She was Hannah Owen's girl. But perhaps she was something more. She stalked through the reeds quickly, before she had time to lose her nerve. Frogs splashed away from her and small fish darted into the depths. When she was knee-deep, she threw herself in. She floated perfectly without effort or skill, exactly as Rebecca had. Curious, she climbed onto a rock. She closed her eyes and leapt, her heart pounding, wondering if she would sink to the mucky depths. Instead, Maria landed so hard on the surface of the water that it took her breath away. Try as she might, she couldn't sink. When she staggered onto the shore, Maria shivered as she pulled on her clothing, not because of the night air, but because her situation had become quite clear to her. She could not be drowned. Rebecca left while they were sleeping, just as Hannah had predicted she would. Twice she had managed to come to this place, once when her daughter was born, when she ran off through the snow, and now again when she wanted to see how the girl had grown. She was not the sort of woman to say farewell. Hannah and Maria awoke when they heard the door close behind her, and as it did, the future became the present, and the present became the past. The witch had only stayed a night, but one night was all it took for her husband to find her. This wasn't love. Maria knew that without anyone telling her. It was ownership and revenge. They could hear horses in Devotion Field and the barking of hounds, all of which gave Hannah time enough to pack what mattered most in a leather satchel. Cheese and bread, a change of clothes, Maria's grimoire, a sprig of juniper for protection, a spool of blue thread, packets of herbs, the makings for courage tea, the painted black hand mirror, along with the fine wool baby blanket that had been in Maria's basket when loving hands abandoned her. Hannah took Maria as far as the pond. They had hustled so quickly that they were soon out of breath. The sky was clear, a perfect day. Hannah had vowed never to leave her home, but the girl had her future ahead of her. She was told to run until the forest ended, then to keep on through the fens until she reached the sea. This wasn't a country for someone with her bloodline. She'd do better in a new world, one where a woman wasn't considered worthless. But where will you be, Maria begged to know. I'll be here where I belong. They couldn't drag me back to the world I used to know. Hannah shoved her own grimoire into the girl's hand. No one gave up such a treasure unless her own end was near. Burn this as soon as you can, and whatever you do, don't come back here. For revenge. A wax figure cast into fire can cause damage or death. A curse thrown to bind a man to the place where he stood. Nightshade, wolfsbane, foxglove, yew, fire. The bones of a bird baked into a pie of thorns. When Rebecca's husband arrived, the death watch beetle came out of the wall and sat on the threshold of the cottage. Its appearance came as no surprise to Hannah, who had known all along that her time was near. There were 10 men in all, half of them his brothers, worked up into a fury of rage. They immediately took Hannah for a witch and tied her to her front door. They nailed her shadow to the ground so she couldn't escape. These men knew a cunning woman when they saw one. Give her a chance and she'd poison you or seek to do you harm. She might look old, she might walk with difficulty, but even more than most women, she was not to be trusted. When questioned about the red-haired lady, Hannah simply said, "She's gone home. If you think you want her, you'll regret it." Rebecca's husband told his brothers to leave Hannah where she was as they burned down her house. What was the life of one old woman worth? Nothing to these men. They thought she couldn't fight back, but she could. Sparks flew everywhere, and in no time the apothecary garden beside the house caught fire, including the plants in the poison garden that Maria had learned not to pluck from the earth. Yarrow and black nightshade, wolfsbane with its purple hooded flowers, foxglove that could slow a heart, you, lords and ladies laden with poisonous berries, all went up aflame, their dark fumes breathed in by the very men cheering on the blaze. The husband of the red-haired lady, a man named Thomas Lockland, had come closest, so he might shoot an arrow through the witch's heart, and because of this the poison affected him more than the others, leaving him unable to speak or move or see. Smoke soon caught in his men's chests. They began to cough and retch. Then they were beset by dizzy spells. They did their best to run for their lives, but in the end they all lay sick in Devotion Field. Though none ever truly recovered, not a single one died on that day. For what you gave to the world would come back to you threefold. And what Hannah was most proud to give to the world was a 10-year-old girl who had more knowledge than most grown men, and more courage as well. Maria had not done as she was told. It was a lesson she'd learned from Hannah. Do what you know is right. She watched from a hillside and wept as the house burned. When it was over and the men had gone, she went back to add Hannah's grimoire to the fire. The smoke was green as it arose in spirals into the canopy of trees. It was a lifetime of knowledge given back to the world from which it had come. Maria saw a glimmer in the grass, the brass bell that had been attached to Hannah's door. She took it with her so that she would always remember to keep her door open to those in need. By evening, Maria had reached the fens, where the land was so marshy and wet the hem of her skirt was sodden and her leather shoes were soaked through, for she was ankle-deep in mud. She carried the satchel Hannah had packed held high over her head to keep it dry as she followed the path of the crow westward. She wept to think of Hannah, and her tears turned hot and burned her cheeks when she thought of Rebecca, who had caused the end of one fate and the start of another. She was so close to the sea that when Maria licked her lips, she tasted salt. There were different kinds of birds here, gulls and terns that wheeled through the pink-tinged sky. Soon the water she walked through was brackish, and all along the shore small crabs burrowed in the mud. Maria climbed a tree in which to safely rest for the evening,
and from that high vantage point she could see blue in the distance, the miraculous sea. There was her future before her. She already knew that the past was over and done. She would never again watch another woman burn.